All right, welcome back. It is 12:43 now on Tuesday, February 2nd. And we're going to pick up with this Alkind chapter and do a little bit more work in the Alkind chapter. One of the things that I want to announce now that everybody's here, though, is that the first quiz is up online. So I have a quiz up in Canvas. And its due date is Friday. So I don't know what day that is. Friday is the, fifth? Yeah. And it's due at midnight.
Is it on material that we'll learn up until Thursday or through
Thursday? It is not. It is on material that we have already had. So you can go and take care of it and do it right now. So yeah, what I do is whenever I put up a quiz or a test or something, it's not like I'm going to backdate it for material that is coming up. I'm going to make that quiz for whatever material we've covered so you can start it and do it right away. And it does harken back to some of the alkene stuff. So I do have a reaction scheme up there that has one product going to a second, going to a third, going to a fifth, going to a sixth, and all the products are shown. It's asking you to fill in the reagents in order to be able to accomplish those transformations. So you have to think critically and carefully about what's happening, what you're seeing in each step, and what reagent is required in order to do that step. And then the second one is more of a mechanistic one, where we were doing the double hydrohalogenations. We were adding two equivalents of HCl or HBr to an alkyne. And what I did is I changed the alkyne up and I put a special group on it, either an electron donating or withdrawing group. And that means that you'll have some regioselectivity to think through, just the way that we were thinking through when we went through and did those. And we looked at the two possible cations that could be created, figure out which is the more stable cation, proceed through that mechanism. That's the exact same skill set that I'm asking you to reproduce just with a new electron donating or withdrawing group on it. So there you go. That's what you got to do. Oh, another thing. Okay, so we're working in an online environment, in an online world where we have very little social interaction. And yet I know that when instructors put things up online, like quizzes and exams and things, that they're trying to lock them all down. And they're trying to lock them down because they don't want students interacting and cheating and working with each other. And teachers are being very careful about what information is being put up on Chegg and other sites where answer keys go up. And there's this whole thing of academic integrity and doing all of that. And I take a different stance on that. So I go sort of a different direction. I'm going to encourage you to work together. I'm going to tell you that it's okay to work together. You guys can go and download the quiz and talk as much as you want and share answers. And I encourage you to form a study group and to actually work together, because that's how we would work in the real life. That's how we would work in the world. And you're not going to find the answers for these things on Chegg, because I just make them up off the top of my head as I'm doing it. So, and if you load it up to Chegg, it doesn't matter, because I'm going to just make a new one next semester anyway, and it really doesn't matter. So knock yourself out, have fun. I think that there's a lot to be learned in terms of discussing these and working through problems. And so I take a different track on that. And I think that's also why I ask that, like, if a Discord channel does get set up, that I get integrated into that Discord channel, because I encourage you to work together. I don't care if it's a test question or a quiz question or what it is. So, and that gives me the opportunity to chime in and constructively direct conversations and constructively show you how to collaborate. So no, it is not timed. It's just wide open. It's up there now and available, and you can work on it as much or as little as you want until Friday. And if you need more time beyond Friday, for some reason that something comes up, then just let me know and we'll make that work too. So, and yeah, there's that Discord has been created. Somebody's got that Discord. Maybe they could put it into the chat again. And at some point I'll try and jump in and join it. I've just been a little busy creating videos. So, okay, that's my soapbox. I'm jumping down off the soapbox now, and let's go ahead and let's start some teaching. By the way, I am like the odd man out in the faculty. And so don't out me that I'm just gonna kill me, that I'm just undermining everything that they're trying to do. But I just look at it a different way. And you know what? Last semester, the exams, when they were all working together, the exam scores did not shift all that much. They really just don't. People are still gonna make mistakes. People are still going to deviate with their own answers, and they should when they feel that they have the right answer. And collaboration is just a way of working through problems and helping each other and to learn the material. And that's what I'm asking for, is I'm asking for you to learn the material. I'm not asking for you to learn it on your own. I'm asking for you to learn it. And anything that I can do that facilitates learning is a good thing. So that's what I'm looking for. Copying and just copying something to get it done and get it turned in, that's not the best idea. And that's not going to help you in the long run. So think about that as you're working, and work with good intentions and contribute. If you're working with a group, try to contribute to that group in terms of, and there's two ways to contribute. One is to explain and to take a lot of time to help other people around you and explain it. That reinforces your knowledge base and helps to reinforce your understanding of the material. And it's also helping the person that you're explaining to. And it should go both ways as you go from problems to problems. Sometimes people need explaining to, sometimes people have the answer and they can do more explaining. So make it a collaborative effort. Okay. So we left off looking at keto-enol tautomerism. We looked at the hydration reactions, and we looked at the hydroboration reactions of those alkynes. So that took me through the tautomers. There's a couple of other reactions that I want to show that show the formation of alkynes that is important to show as well. So let me pick it up with those before moving on to the few last reactions in this chapter. So one of the reactions that I would like to remind you of is that in the alkene chapter, this is alkynes, but I'm going to back it up for a minute here. And we're going to look at a reaction to remind you about in the alkenes. When we took Br2 and added Br2 to this.
Are you writing?
Oh, I am.
I can't see your screen.
Let's see what happened. Perfect. It's showing me.
I can see it now.
Can you? Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe when I had the Zoom screen over it, it prevented it from showing. I'll throw you guys over to the right, and then we'll do it here. Okay. When we do Br2, the bromine gets polarized just by its inherent polarizability. You can think of it as a van der Waals force that winds up happening, that as the bromine gets close to the electron density in the double bond, it polarizes the bromine, creating the partial positive. And then you get the addition, but that addition winds up leading to what we call the cyclic bromonium ion. And then that cyclic bromonium ion gets attacked by the bromide to come in and do a anti-addition, so that if I look at a molecule, I'll have to draw a proper molecule to show you. But if we had it on a ring system, we could see it. This would be anti-addition. So if we were in something like a five-membered ring system, one bromine would be down and one bromine would be up. This is what we mean by anti-addition. As opposed to if you had that same five-membered ring and you did a syn addition, syn coming from the same side of a double bond, syn addition would look like both bromines on the same side. Okay, so we don't see sin addition with these. We only see the anti-addition.
Just to be clear, that was an alkene, right?
It would have started from an alkene. It would have started from a five-member double bond. And I guess maybe the best way that I could do that is to show you, let's say that we had the five-member ring system with the double bond, and we do Br2. It would lead to these two products, the anti-addition product, the syn addition product, and the syn addition product is not observed. So the mechanism is one of anti-addition, because this is really an SN2 step, a backside attack on an SN2 step, which is why you get inversion of configuration in the anti-addition. Okay, so that's a reminder of a reaction that happened in the alkenes. And what we can do with those is that when we have halogens that are like this, we can do double dehydrohalogenation. So if I take two equivalents of sodium amide, strong base, this would be in liquid ammonia, the mechanism goes through by the amide pulling the proton. This is inherently an E2 step, E2 elimination, which first gives the double bond. And then that undergoes a second elimination. Pulling the proton. Now this isn't an E2 step, but it is an elimination, which then creates the terminal alkyne. And then if there is no second acidification step, because of the acidity of these, that terminal proton also gets pulled. And so the final product out of this is the anion. So what we're basically showing is a method of moving from an alkene to an alkyne. So one of the things that you can envision now is that you can envision taking an alkene, reacting it with Br2, making the dibromide, and then a reaction whereby I react with sodium amide. Let's do this number one. And then number two, I would do dilute acid. That's the protonation step. And that then would make the alkyne. So it's a way of moving from an alkene into making an alkyne. And what's cool about this too, is that any way in which you can get two bromines or two chlorines, two halogens on a molecule, we can do this double dehydrohalogenation. And so it works when the two halogens are in this type of position. If I go through and I do sodium amide, and then two dilute acid, that's the protonation step. It will create the alkyne. If I have the two halogens and they are on the terminal end, it will do the same reaction. And if the two halogens are 1, 2, it will do the same reaction. So any configuration of the dihalogens can result in the alkyne production. And this is called double dehydrohalogenation.
Jason, really quickly, just to kind of backtrack, when you were talking about taking the alkene to form the dihalide.
Yes.
It seems kind of arbitrary, but I don't really get like why the convention of syn and anti exists, because it does. It seems like that when you form the 1,2 dibromide, wouldn't it just be able to rotate until they were on the same side?
Oh, dude, that is such a great question, and it makes a total difference. How do I show you? Best ways to show you. What we say is that this halogenation reaction with Br2 is stereoselective. For anti. Okay, so let's say that we have, and it favors syn. Oops, favors anti over syn. So let's say that I give you a double bond that has different substituents on it. So we'll put a hydrogen here, we'll leave one as a methyl. And then I'll put another one as an ethyl. And the last one, let's put an aromatic ring in its place. Okay, now we do Br2. Okay, so as we go and do Br2 this time, and it adds to it, we create the cyclic bromonium ion. There's a hydrogen, the methyl, the ethyl, and the aromatic ring. And then the bromide comes in, presumably on the less sterically hindered side, because it's an SN2 reaction, knocking out the bromine. And as it does that, it goes through inversion of configuration, such that what gets created is the ethyl, the aromatic ring system, the bromide. This bromide is anti to it, and back is the hydrogen, and forward is the methyl. These now are stereocenters. And no amount of rotation can change the configuration that resulted in the creation of those stereocenters.
That makes a lot more sense. Okay, the textbook just didn't have examples that showed the two stereocenters, so I think I just kind of lost it. But that was really helpful. Thank you.
Correct. You're welcome. And so anti versus syn addition becomes important in two very important areas. Anti versus syn matters when you have a ring. And on prochiral stereocenters.
Will you scroll up a little again?
Yes. So prochiral. Prochiral means something that can become chiral. So that's what we mean by prochiral. And the molecule that we had here that had the differences on the double bond is prochiral, in that the addition of the bromine results in chiral bonds. Chiral carbons, chiral stereocenters. And so that's where anti versus syn really comes into play. So it's important to understand the mechanism, because the mechanism becomes important in certain molecules. So we just need to know where we need to pay attention to it and where we don't. So Sterling, that's a great question. Thank you for that. Okay, moving forward. Let's do a quick ask. Maybe you can tell me I want to make this so actually you can't make that just yet, but you can make this. This is a good segue. I don't know if Zoruba does these types of problems. And these are the types of problems that we're going to start moving towards. What this is a synthesis problem. And we're sort of getting ready to be able to do the synthesis chapter. What these arrows indicate is it takes more than one step. The arrows do not indicate how many steps it takes. This doesn't mean that it takes three steps. I just always use three arrows to indicate that something takes more than one step. This is your starting material. And a desired product. I have a whole set that we go through of how do you do synthesis? How do we do this type of thing? And it all stems from what we call retrosynthesis. So retrosynthesis is, if you imagine back to being a kid and being given a maze at a restaurant, a puzzle at a restaurant in order to fill out with crayons, and you had to draw, go in and draw, try to find your way to the center of the maze. Most of the time, it was easier to work backwards. If you start in the center and you work your way back out and you try to get out the exit, you're oftentimes more successful. That there's less traps moving backwards than there are moving forwards. These problems are exactly the same way. There are many more traps trying to go forwards than there are going backwards. So what we tend to do is we tend to work backwards using a specific arrow, which means retrosynthesis. It means I'm going to tear the molecule apart. This is a bond right here that I know how to put back together. That bond could be created if I had an alkynyl anion that I could react with something like methyl bromide. And that if I had those two molecules and I reacted them together, they would go together to make that thing at the top. All right. This piece that is over here, the methyl bromide, this piece is done. And I don't need to do anything more to that. That's just a reagent that I could add. But I need to work on this piece over here to make it look like that piece over there. It needs to go back to that starting alkane. And so I need to think about where these molecules could come from, this alkynyl anion. And there's maybe three different molecules that I could consider to be progenitors of this molecule. One is that if I had two halogens in that position, I can make that alkynyl anion out of it. If I had two halogens in this position, I can make that. Or if I had two halogens that were on the terminal end, I could make that alkynyl anion from any of those three, because that's the dehydrohalogenation reaction that allows me to do that. So now I need to look back at this molecule and think, well, can any of these be made from that? And the answer is no, not directly. But in looking at it, what I do see is that this one has some strong possibilities. in that from that molecule, I could easily envision starting from something that had a double bond in that position, right? And that simple bromination of this molecule could lead to that. And so now I've got to connect this back to my starting material over here. And maybe a good connection for that is to say, oh, I could have something in here that maybe had a leaving group in this position. And I might be able to get that from that starting material there. And now I've done a retrosynthetic analysis where I don't have actual molecules yet, but I do have a pathway forward that I can envision. Watch this set of reactions that we're going to do. So I'm going to zoom that up there. And I'm going to take and go in the forwards direction now. And what I'll do is take this guy and I'll react it first with, let's do HBr and peroxide. Do you remember this reaction from the alkene chapter? In this reaction, the bromide goes anti-Markovnikov. It goes in the opposite direction from what we would normally expect, which takes and puts the bromide on the less substituted carbon. And then if I want to create the double bond on the terminal end, I could use a bulky base to pull the proton on the terminal end rather than a small base that would pull on the more substituted position. So this is a reaction where we're looking at regioselectivity of elimination. So we'll use a bulky base, something like lithium diisopropyl amide, LDA. Let's put it in parentheses that this is LDA. Or maybe you didn't use LDA. Maybe in your class, the base that you chose to use was potassium tert-butoxide. LDA and potassium tert-butoxide are sort of interchangeable bulky bases that will pull the most accessible proton. That creates the double bond on the terminal end. And now I can go through and I can add bromine to this to make the dihalogen. Go through the elimination with sodium amide. Question?
Jason, why are you using KOBO again? Sorry.
It is potassium tert-butoxide. So potassium, oxygen, linked to a tert-butyl. And that is what we call a bulky base. That base is selective for pulling the least sterically hindered proton. It will not be able to get into, there's two protons that can pull. So there's the proton that is here, and then there's the proton that is here. Let's say that this one is sterically hindered by all the different substituents around it, making it hard for a base which is very bulky to get in towards it. This is a proton which is a tertiary proton or on a tertiary carbon. The other proton that's on the terminal end, this one is primary with no sterics. And so it is much easier for this base to pull that proton to do the elimination to get the E2 product. And so this is an E2 reaction with a bulky base, which is why it goes that direction.
So the thought process would be like, I need to remove bromine. How do I do that? And then that's how you choose a bulky base.
It depends. So let me answer that in 1 second. Let me finish this and then I'll answer the bulky base question of different reactions. Let me just finish up this thought, which is with sodium amide, we go through the double dehydrohalogenation, which makes the anion, the sodium becomes the counter for it. And the last step is to add in methyl bromide. And we're at our product. Let me address that bulky base step, because honestly, the reason that I kind of chose this off the top of my head to do this way is because I just kind of wanted to see where we were sitting with all of these concepts and see how well we were handling the alkene chapter that came before this that Zaruba had done. So this is sort of like a check-in to see if you guys, how strong you have that alkene chemistry. If we take a molecule that has a bromine in this position, and we want to do an elimination, an E2 reaction, there's two ways to do this elimination reaction. I can do it with a bulky base. Bulky base being potassium tert butoxide, that's one way of writing it, or LDA. These bases are strong bases that have a lot of sterics associated with them. LDA is lithium diisopropyl amide, and so the nitrogen has big bulky groups on it. So those are the two bases that will do that. Those bases, being big and bulky, will be selective for pulling the proton that is the least sterically hindered. So they will go for this proton out here because there's very low sterics around it. When they pull this proton, we get the double bond that is, there's a Zaitsev product. Maybe Zaruba used different language than I did. There's a Zaitsev product in the elimination. And then there is, what is the one that is not Zaitsev? I don't usually use the names for them.
Hoffman?
Maybe it's the Hoffman. Yes, the Hoffman elimination and then the Zaitsev elimination. So this is Zaitsev. And then we look at the Hoffman elimination, which would be with a small base. So these small bases are things like sodium methoxide or sodium ethoxide. These guys tend to pull the protons that give the more substituted double bond, the more stable double bond.
Wait, isn't the Zaitsev the more substituted?
It could be. This is what I just said, that I don't use those terms all the time. I get caught up in the language of people's names. And if you remember them wrong, you screw it all up. And so I try to remember the principle, the underlying principle, more than I try to remember the underlying name. That's at least my philosophy, the way that I look at it. So what we're doing here is that these guys tend to pull the proton that is here, giving you the more substituted double bond. And that is the more stable double bond, the more thermodynamically stable double bond. And so we have control over either of these products just by choosing the appropriate base as to which product we want, which means that we can walk a double bond from one place in a molecule to another place in a molecule. For instance, watch this. I can take the same molecule that I'm dealing with, put the double bond up here, and I can take and I can react it with, let's do HBr. Reacting it with HBr gives me the bromine on the more substituted. I can then take and use a small base, something like sodium methoxide, and do an E2 elimination, giving me the more substituted double bond. I can then treat it with HBr and peroxide, moving the bromine out to this position, and then I can pull it with a bulky base, something like potassium tert butoxide, to then migrate that double bond out to the terminal end of the molecule. So I can move that double bond all around that molecule at will, as I want to, if I wanted to go the other direction. Going the other direction, I could start with that guy and I could do HBr. Now, this I'd have to be careful of, because if I do HBr with this, ooh, who can tell me what's going to happen here? These are all good dusting off the cobwebs questions. What's going to happen when I do HBr with this molecule? I drew it kind of big, so I'm going to shrink it down a little bit. It's going to grab the proton. You grab the proton, you create the carbocation. This is a secondary carbocation. Undergoes hydride shift. Tertiary carbocation. Bromide comes in and attacks tertiary carbocation. And by hydride shift, we end up with that as the major product. So remembering those hydride shifts?
Yeah, it's all coming back.
Okay, well, this is good. Then I don't feel bad that we're spending a little bit of time sort of digging back into this a little bit, backtracking a bit, getting us all on the same page.
Could we go back really quick to the forward direction of kind of that?
Yes.
Could you go over again just to like reinforce why the sodium amide yields the alkali?
Yes, the alkyl anion like this?
Yes.
There's two ways to do this part. Let me show you the two ways to do that part. When we take and react this with sodium amide, there's no real way to do this with just one equivalent. It happens with two equivalents, and there's no way to really control it other than that. So we can write two equivalents, but sometimes this just gets left out. This double dehydrohalogenation, the NH2 pulls the proton, kicking out the bromide in what is an E2. The remaining bromide is then kicked out when the second equivalent of that molecule takes the proton, pushing electrons in, pushing out the bromide, which is also similar to an E2. That leaves us with something that has a pKa, which is in the 26 range for the proton, which is on the terminal end. The base, if I look at NH3, the pKa on NH3 is around 40 to 45, I can't remember exactly. Let's call it 40. Orders of magnitude less acidic than the proton over here. That means that when I'm looking at a competition between how strong a base the amide is and how acidic this proton is, this guy is a way stronger base and easily rips that proton away. So what happens is, the base takes the proton, giving the electrons back to the carbon, and we end up with the carbanion. and the sodium becomes a counterion. So we can go that route. And one way that you typically, now that you understand that chemistry, one way that you typically see this written is you typically see it written number one, sodium amide. Number two, methyl bromide. This is the base and then the nucleophile, electrophile.
Wouldn't you need three equivalent to get to the final stage?
Yeah, this is partly why I don't even put the equivalents there, because there's no way to control this. And so, yes, it takes, if we're taking one equivalent to pull, two equivalents to make this, third equivalent pulling the proton, yes, all the way through. But there's no way to stop it. So even if you only had two equivalents, what happens is chemical reactions don't go in phases. It's not like all of this gets made, and then all of this gets made, and then all of this gets made. A little bit gets pulled, this immediately gets pulled, and this is present, there is base present. The base pulls this proton, goes and makes that product, and you wind up with a smorgasbord of all kinds of products because you don't have the full equivalence of base that you need. And so normally what we would do is we would just use a large excess of the sodium amide in order to push it all towards the anion so that we don't get a mixture of products in this and an uncompleted reaction.
When you add water, does that stop, like, because it's so sensitive, the anion can just rip off the proton and then you get the neutral form?
That is correct. That if we add water, that the reaction stops and we get just the terminal alkyne that is then protonated. So that's what I was going to say. This is one way to do the reaction. And the second way to do the reaction is to take and to react one with the sodium amide, two using dilute acid, of which water is considered to be a dilute acid. So water would work just fine there. That would give you the terminal alkyne. And then you would have to do this anyway, sodium amide to deprotonate it, and then two CH3Br to make the new bond. So you have to go through this step anyway. Whether you stop here and stop at this and isolate that is entirely up to you. So you could just go all the way to that product just by doing that. So this is a big or. Two steps or one step?
What did you say the name of one of these reactions was? A D something?
Double dehydrohalogenation. That was written back here where we just started, double dehydrohalogenation.
What I'm a little bit unsure of is I don't get why the NH2 is specific to the protons it's specific to, or that you drew it being specific to. Like, why it doesn't want the ones next to it, or...
Dylan, maybe you can help me out with where I'm taking the proton in this mechanism here?
Yeah. Towards the bottom. Or I guess like the... In, like any of the steps, like it, in the first one where there's two BRs and it's taking that proton, why doesn't it take the one to the left of it or to the right of it?
Dylan, it can certainly take any of these protons and it could eliminate the back bromine first and we could have a different intermediate, but we're going to get to the same place in the end. So
to the left of that carbon then.
Then you have a difference. Yes, you could pull that proton. That is true. But in pulling that proton, I could see many things that might happen there. It tends to not work out this way. But let's say that for whatever reason, the base did pull this proton. So I'm just going to go to B minus base. Let's say I did pull that and I underwent the elimination because the base is a small base. So not out of the realm of possibility. In pulling that and getting that product, there's the possibility that we could get an alenic system in the next elimination, but it's also possible that what could happen in the next one is to pull the base, which then goes through resonance, because that would be the most likely thing to happen because it's the most acidic proton based on the most stable conjugate base. And then I have resonance, which happens between these two. That resonance most likely has no place to go other than to capture a proton. And in capturing a proton, it's just going to be in an equilibrium where it can snag the proton back. And I'm back where I wanted to be anyway. And then the reaction can go forward from there.
You said it's like less likely. Why is that? Or less common, or?
I don't know that necessarily it's less likely, but what I can say is that if it does happen, the only place for it to go is into this resonance. And once it's into this resonance, it's going to capture a proton in one of these two positions. And no matter which position it captures, if it captures back in this position, I go back to starting material, which has no real place to go. But when it captures on this side, I can then go through the elimination and I end up at my same terminal product anyway.
Gotcha.
And so it's the fact that all of these are reversible. And that once I end up at that terminal alkyne, that's sort of like a dead end road and the reversibility sort of stops, particularly once this thing gets deprotonated. Then there's no easy way for that to reverse. And so, Dylan, it's an extraordinarily good question because it wasn't explained or highlighted why we were choosing certain protons. And the question becomes, well, why are we choosing certain protons? Why is the base choosing to go a certain direction? And the fact is that for many of these eliminations, they go a particular way, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't have a circuitous route in order to getting there, that sometimes we'll get deprotonations in other areas of the molecule that don't lead to a final product that are reversible, that ultimately we're looking at. I always think of it this way. There are many things that could happen in a chemical reaction. And so if we think about this bucket full of water as our chemical reaction and the many things that could be going on inside the chemical reaction, however, within the reactivity that we're looking at, the bucket has a small hole in it. And this is the product that I'm looking to make. And eventually, drop by drop, small bit by small bit, all of the reactivity goes through that hole, even though there's all kinds of other things that are going on in the bucket, eventually the bucket will drain full of water. And our product will wind up in that one product. Does that sort of help to think of it in that way? Cool, okay. Sorry, I don't know why I have a phone in my office. All I do is pick it up and hang it up. Nobody has that number. It's not real. It's just a fake phone. It's there for me to like make calls out. I never give that number to anybody. So nobody but a telemarketer is going to call me on that phone. That is just so that I can hear while I'm on a phone instead of having a crappy cell signal. So that's all that is. Maria, it's a little bit hard because what happens is I can go down and still show things that are up above, but the screen winds up getting so small for me to draw that it starts to get hard to draw. I'll try to be careful.
Okay, that's fine.
No.
Remember too that I take these notes and I post these notes right up online right after we get done with class. So you can always go back and grab the notes offline real quick.
I think I'll do that because sometimes I get like, I focus too much on the writing, but I instead of like listening and then I have notes that are like half done.
Yes.
And so, I think I'll pay more attention to listening and then go back and go to notes and use them to like finish whatever I didn't get to do.
So I apologize. My daughter right now is at Western Washington University and she's going through OCHEM right now. And she's just saying, oh my God, he lectures so fast. And she can't keep up. And so her method is to just, I said, don't take notes, stop. Just stop taking notes, just watch. It's all recorded. Go back and watch the video and take your notes from the video once it's done. There's something to be said for just really deeply paying attention, especially in a format when you can go back and you can take notes from the video later if you want to. Although I do acknowledge that that is a huge time sink to go back and to watch it all and that you only have so much time. So there, yeah, if you can do some sort of in between, take some notes and then go back to rewrite those notes maybe from the video. Might be helpful.
I had kind of a quick question about, or just to wrap up the which hydrogen to choose deal.
Sure.
I thought you took not the hydrogen we did in that example right there, but I thought you took the other ones because they were like more acidic.
More acidic versus less acidic. Not easily answered.
I thought it might have something to do with it's near the bromine, which would be like, you know, moving around charge.
Yeah. More acidic versus less acidic. When we look at the protons, if this is an electron withdrawing group, it's sucking electron density out of this molecule. And supposedly, these two would have the largest partial positive. As inductively, the electron withdrawing group falls off with distance, the partial positive on these should be smaller. Now, which ones are more acidic? It could be argued that the protons that are geminal, is the way that we refer to it, on the same carbon with the bromide, would be the more acidic ones because of their larger partial positive nature. However, the protons that are over here, while not being more acidic, actually lead to a stable product. And so, you know, if we look at the pulling of those two protons, the pulling of this proton by some base dumps the electron density into the antibonding orbital. So we're taking the sigma bond. What is the sigma bond that is here? And the anti-sigma bond, which looks kind of like this. This is the sigma star orbital. And we're dumping that electron density into the sigma star orbital, breaking the sigma bond on the bromine and kicking the bromine out. And in so doing, we go to the double bond. And this is a stable neutral product. These are generally thought of as being endothermic reactions. And in that transition state of that E2 reaction, the transition state is product-like, so that what we're getting is we're getting a partial minus on the base and a partial minus on the bromide. And that transition state is going to be governed by the structure of the double bond, which is why we get kinetic versus thermodynamic. In terms of the products, we get the Zaitsev versus the Hoffman product. That's where that Hoffman and Zaitsev selectivity comes from, is in the stability of the actual product itself. And so does this proton have a special acidity by virtue of being anti to the bromide? Somewhat, but more so it's just random probability that while these protons may not be as acidic as these guys over here, pulling these does not lead to a product because you can't eliminate the bromide. And so even if you do pull these protons, they simply pull the proton back in an equilibrium from the base and it doesn't move forward to product. So sometimes, yes, there is a clear choice of more acidic proton and a distinct reason on why we're choosing a proton. Sometimes it's not about the acidity of the proton, but the viability of pulling the proton leading to a stable product that has no way back. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Cool. Okay. I just have to stop and say how much I appreciate all of your questions. You guys are showing that you're like invested in it, you're tracking with it, and you're asking really, really good questions. You're keeping me from moving forward, but that's okay. Because I'm feeling the learning. There's lots of good learning going on here. Okay, are you willing to let me move forward to a new reaction? Just checking in, seeing how everybody's doing. Okay, the next reaction I want to look at is to remind you about catalytic hydrogenation. Okay, remember this reaction. I'm always starting from the alkenes because I'm just trying to remind you guys of everything that we've done. This could be platinum or palladium on carbon doing hydrogenation where we take and we add hydrogen across the double bond. This is a type of syn addition. It happens on a reaction surface. This is the palladium metal. The palladium metal adsorbs hydrogen onto its surface. And the mechanism is such that in the bond making process, electrons travel this direction and this direction, first making a carbon platinum bond, and then a reductive elimination where electrons go back to the platinum or palladium, and this guy goes to the carbon. And because of that, it is a syn addition, meaning from the same face. This goes back to Stirling's question of why do I track syn versus anti? Because if I had stereocenters on this molecule, which I don't, it would make a big difference if it was prochiral as to which face the hydrogens came from. I would end up with diastereomers if I looked at syn versus anti-addition. So something to remember. This catalytic hydrogenation also occurs for alkynes. So I can take an alkyne and I can go through and I can hydrogenate this. And if I do take hydrogen on palladium or carbon, on palladium or platinum or nickel. There's rainy nickel. There's all different sorts of things. It will go all the way down from the alkyne to the alkane. And with this reagent, there's no way to stop in the middle. There's no way to do just one equivalent. However, there are some reagents where I can change that and I can make a difference. So there are types of reagents that are called poison catalysts. These reagents all have a particular look to them. They are hydrogen mixed with palladium on calcium carbonate. And then they oftentimes have another catalyst, such as lead oxide. This is what's called a Lindlar type, or this one is actually Lindlar. They are in a class of what are called poisoned catalysts. Did I get stuck here? I got the wrong eraser. These catalysts do stop at the alkene. And so you can get the alkene from these types of catalysts. Some ways of recognizing them, and there's various different types that are here. So poison catalysts. We just saw the hydrogen and palladium on calcium carbonate. With lead oxide. The other one uses what's called quinoline. This one also on calcium carbonate. And then quinoline, you'll usually just see it written. But quinoline is an organic molecule. It's supposed to be a nitrogen that's down in here. That's the quinoline molecule. That one is also a poison catalyst. Let me see if I have some of the others. I don't. Oh, one more. Palladium on barium sulfate. So these are all versions of poison catalysts. And so what I do is I recognize these as being additional, something additional that is out of the norm of a normal hydrogenation. And that means that these will all take an alkyne and stop it at the alkene. So we could put an R group out here in terms of what those reagents are doing.
And that still adds syn, right?
And it will add syn, which is excellent. So let's take and think about what that means in terms of adding syn. So these are all syn additions. So the syn addition means that when I look at that from the prospect of a molecule that maybe has a triple bond in it. And let's do an ethyl group there, but let's put this on a six-member ring system. And we take and we do the hydrogen with the palladium. Let's use the barium sulfate. Then what I get is I get a syn addition, which takes me to the double bond, but the two hydrogens come from the same face. And so I end up here with a cis double bond. Or Z double bond. And it's probably a good idea. This is number 1, 2, 3, 4, just to check. 1, 2, 3, 4, so that we don't make a mistake in terms of drawing this. Okay, but what if I didn't want that? What if I didn't want the cis double bond? What if I wanted the trans double bond? How do I get the trans double bond? BbNH3, okay, you're remembering this, that's good. And sodium, that's right. So we use the dissolving metals reaction. So the dissolving metals reaction is a free radical reaction that goes through an entirely different mechanism that allows for the rotation of the bond in the formation. And so that reaction is the dissolving metals reaction. So if you desire a trans product, we use what is called dissolving metals. And this is sodium with, and that's sodium metal with ammonia. Okay, in this reaction, what happens is that this same material that we were looking at reacting, when reacted with sodium metal in liquid ammonia, goes through and does an anti-addition. And it's because it goes through a different mechanism. So rather than working on a surface, unlike what are called these heterogeneous catalysis. Heterogeneous catalysis means that I'm working in different phases. So these guys have a solid support, and because of the approach to the solid support is from one phase, we get the syn addition. These guys down here have a dissolved metal and there is no solid support. And without the solid support, the reaction mechanism is entirely different. So what happens here is this is a free radical reaction. So if you're remembering the mechanism, what we do is we take, let's not worry about the structure of the alkyne, let's just focus on the mechanism itself. The sodium metal has a lone electron. The bond here breaks. One electron goes to join this electron, and one electron goes back to that carbon. In breaking in that way, we now have a double bond, the R group, and what is a lone pair constituting the negative charge on that carbon. And this carbon has a free radical. So this is what's called a radical anion. That radical anion then acts as a base to pick up a proton from the ammonia. So the ammonia is acting as a proton source, and the base picks up that proton. We still have the free radical, but another equivalent of sodium comes in and donates its electron in order to make the anion. And as we make the anion, that guy now winds up seeking to have the R groups on different sides of the molecule for steric reasons. And now as the anion, this will now grab another proton from another ammonia. And we end up with our final product. So it allows for rotation for steric reasons to give the anti-substitution. So that's our reaction mechanism, which is kind of cool. Very different from the other reaction with the metal. And this can be referred to as dissolving metals, and Sterling, you're right, it could also be called dissolving ammonia, ammonium reduction. They are equivalent names for the reaction. All right, that gets us to just about everything that I want to do. Checking my time. Let me take what's left of my time here and to take a terminal alkyne. And let's look at some different reactions that we can do with this. We can take and react it with a halogen. And that was actually not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do HX. And usually, I think it's hard to go one equivalent. No, that's right. I'm doing it right. So we do need two equivalents. I'll keep track of equivalents down here. This will give the two halogens substituting onto the same carbon. So that's one reaction that we covered. We covered the reaction whereby we can treat this with water, H2SO4, and mercury sulfate. And this goes through an intermediate, which is the enol, but quickly tautomerizes to give the ketone. So the ketone being the final product there. Alternatively, we could do hydroboration. And then oxidation. This one also goes through an enol, but it is the opposite enol. And that quickly tautomerizes to give the aldehyde. We can take it and we can react it with X2, and we can create a dihalogen, not very useful. But things that things that are covered in this. So if we do X2 excess, also not useful. Interesting things that you can do that just don't get you anywhere really. One reaction that we didn't cover which I think is in the book, is ozonolysis. You remember ozonolysis of double bonds? Remember how you get two carbonyls, so it splits the double bond, you get two carbonyls? This one does sort of similar. So we do one ozonolysis, and usually we work this up with something like zinc and water. In this case, what we wind up getting is a carboxylic acid. And the other side becomes CO2 gas that we lose from the terminal. If the alkyne is a terminal alkyne and we do ozonolysis, so this one's internal and zinc and water, you end up with two carboxylic acids. And there's no way to do anything more interesting with this. So it splits it into two carboxylic acids, if it's that type. And then the last thing that we can do with these is to take this guy. Let's do, he's a bigger arrow. And to treat this with one sodium amide, and then two, some sort of primary alkyl halide, and it must be primary. That's like really critically important. This will make, and let's call this R prime, and this will make R triple bond R prime. And then from there, we could take that, and that guy has just a couple of little things that we can do with it. We could treat it with sodium and NH3. In order to be able to make the trans double bond, we can treat it with H2 and Linlar. I don't have quite enough room in there, so I'm going to make some more room for myself. This would make the cis double bond. And then the last thing is we could just simply hydrogenate it. This is just H2 and palladium. And we can make it into the alkane. So there's all these things that we've covered now. And I refer to these, and I don't know if Zaruba uses these. I organize all my reactions this way. I call this a star chart. One of my favorite things about Klein is that when I opened Klein for the first time, Klein had star charts. I had never seen any other chemistry instructor organize things in star charts. It was just something that I've always done. And so to see another chemistry instructor do it and actually do it in a textbook was like super exciting, because it very concisely takes all of your reactions and puts them all in one place, starting from a substrate, that makes it really easy to use on a test or a quiz, or it's just a very dense piece of information. And what you can imagine is that as we're going along, you know, we've got an alkene star chart, and there's many more reactions that come off the alkenes. So the alkenes just have a ton of reactions that we went through. But in some of those reactions, what they take us to were things that have the dihalogens on them, which then take us over to alkynes and that star chart. And that what we find is we start getting connections between these different star charts. And those connections then become your roadmaps within synthesis of how I move from one functional group to another functional group. And a way of organizing your thought process to think through, how am I going to get from point A to point B? Okay, so that's sort of like big picture. It's kind of where we're going. But we finished up with the alkyne chapter now. And you guys have a quiz to do. I'll think of another quiz for next week. And we'll pick it up from the alkynes and we go into, I don't know, there's a free radical chapter, I think, is the next chapter that we pick up in. And we'll start down that road, okay? It is after 2 o'clock. I'm 4 minutes over time. I'm gonna let you guys go, but I will stay on the line to answer any questions that anybody has, and I'll hang out here for a little bit. So with that, thank you guys. Thanks for your attention and hanging in there with me.
Thank you.
And fast-paced, rapid lecture. And I'll see you guys later. Okay, and since we're going to do questions, if we're going to do questions, I am going to stop the recording. Because...